Thank you, Michael. I'd like to begin with a few brief words of thanks. The Bolzanskaya Lectureship in Modern Intellectual History, now in its second year, is already well established. I consider myself enormously fortunate to have had the benefit of holding this lectureship, which provides, as Michael described, a term sabbatical in which to think, to read, and of course, to write. So I need to thank, first and foremost, Professor Quentin Skinner for creating such a valuable position for younger scholars. It is truly a boon to those of us beginning our careers in the field of political thought and intellectual history. I also want to thank the two institutions that together manage the lectureship for this university, the Faculty of History and the Center for Research in the Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities. In the faculty, Professor Michael O'Brien helped me piece together a program for tomorrow's colloquium. Professor Tony Badger, Master of Clare College, also provided much needed support. My thanks to them both. Finally, I also want to express my deeply felt gratitude to the director of CRASH, Professor Mary Jacobus, and to the center's extraordinary staff who helped me settle into a term of research and who have also carried out all of the hard work of organizing and promoting the Bolzanskaya Lecture and Colloquium this year. As someone who works, oddly enough, on the history of interdisciplinarity, I was struck in both corridor conversations I had here with other fellows and in the weekly work in progress seminars chaired by Professor Jacobus, that this was what all of the fuss was about. Three times a year, CRASH creates a genuine community of scholars from across the disciplines, and I was grateful to belong to one of them this year. In the autumn of 1940, Bertrand Russell delivered the William James Lectures at Harvard University. As the most distinguished living representative of a philosophical program known variously as analytical philosophy, logical analysis, or more simply, scientific philosophy, Russell spoke for those who found their paradigm of philosophical inquiry in the technical yet programmatic work of philosophers of logic, mathematics, and science. In different forms, scientific philosophy had flourished during the interwar period in the major cities of Europe, Berlin, Paris, Vienna, Warsaw, and Prague. Now, as war engulfed the continent, the tradition of scientific philosophy took firm root in the United States. Russell's audience at Harvard included several former members of the Vienna Circle. Among them were Rudolf Carnap, then visiting from the University of Chicago, Herbert Feigl, on a Rockefeller Foundation fellowship, and Philip Frank, who held a part-time lectureship in physics and mathematics at Harvard. Also in attendance were one-time satellite members of the circle, notably the Polish logician Alfred Tarski and the mathematician Richard von Mises. Some of these men, like Feigl and Carnap, emigrated before the disasters of Hitler's imperial project began to unfold. Others had been stranded at Harvard since the 1939 International Congress of the Unity of Science, which opened in Emerson Hall on the same day that Britain declared war on the Third Reich. Harvard, in those early months of the war, played host to what one observer aptly characterized as the Vienna Circle, with some accretions in international exile. The revival of the Vienna Circle in Cambridge, Massachusetts, was aided by a number of sympathetic Americans. Willard von Orman Quine, an instructor in philosophy and logic at Harvard, had studied with Carnap and Tarski in the early 1930s. Along with the physicist Percy Williams Bridgman and the physiological psychologist Stanley Smith Stevens, Quine helped to support the fledgling Harvard Circle of scientific philosophers. Beginning in September 1940, Stevens, Quine, Carnap, Feigl, and Frank organized a cross-faculty Science of Science discussion group. The group met at the Harvard Faculty Club on Thursdays at 6:30 p.m., the same day and time at which the Vienna Circle convened its meetings more than a decade earlier in the Philosophical Library of the University of Vienna's Mathematical Institute. When historians examine the rise of analytic philosophy or philosophical analysis in the United States, it is to developments such as these that they point. According to some, the emigre scientific philosophers cleared the field for technical work in epistemology, semantics, and mathematical logic, and decimated in the process indigenous populations of pragmatists, critical realists, and naturalists. Stanley Cavell has captured the essence of this view in a story about an elderly colleague of his in the Berkeley Philosophy Department in the late 1950s. The professor confessed to Cavell that an encounter with the convener of the Vienna Circle, Moritz Schlick, left his own philosophical views so shaken that he had considered abandoning his career and going to medical school. Only his advanced age prevented him from doing so, and he decided instead to, quote, brave it out in philosophy until retirement. Less anecdotally, the philosopher of science Michael Friedman and his students have treated the intellectual migration as a turning point in the history of logical empiricism. Whereas the Vienna Circle and its affiliates were interested in unifying the mathematical and natural sciences through a metalinguistic account of the a priori, a commitment expressed most systematically in Rudolf Carnap's discipline of Wissenschaftslogik, or logic of science. After the emigration, this constructive program fell before W.V. Quine's attack on the analytic synthetic distinction and his advocacy of naturalism in philosophical inquiry. Other scholars have also called attention to the stripping away of the political and cultural aspirations of the exiled Vienna Circle in the context of the Cold War, a conjuncture that some suggest transformed scientific philosophy into an intramural, purely professional enterprise known as analytic philosophy. My purpose in this lecture is to present an alternative framework for investigating the rise and consolidation of analytic philosophy in the United States. The consequences of the migration of scientific philosophy from Europe to America are liable to be misunderstood when the topic is approached in the manner I have just sketched. Existing historical accounts offer variations on a stage theory of conceptual change. An interwar pluralism in professional philosophy in the United States on this reckoning was replaced by the construction of a hegemonic tradition of analytic philosophy rooted in logical technique, in linguistic analysis, and an overweening scientism in epistemology and ethics. Then, with the emergence of a post-analytic philosophy, the analytic paradigm was called into question by dissenters committed to neopragmatism, critical theory, hermeneutics, and so on. This scheme is not straightforwardly wrong, but it organizes the historical record in unhelpful and misleading ways. In particular, philosophers and historians alike, no doubt impressed by the striking image of an entire philosophical culture transported from the cafes of Vienna to the seminar rooms of Harvard University, have tended to buy into the view that the migration meant, for American philosophy, the suspension of interests in ethics, value theory, and normative conceptions of social action and rationality. In what follows, I seek to move away from the stage theory and to outline a different set of parameters within which to consider the analytic revolution in American philosophy. I shall argue that analytic philosophy in the American context must be understood as part of a broader set of mid-20th century developments in the mathematical and behavioral sciences, and that these developments in turn were rooted in transformative changes in the pursuit of science and scholarship in the United States. I cannot hope to cover all of this ground in a single lecture. Instead, I will use an assessment of the early career of the philosopher Donald Davidson as a basis for introducing these broader themes. In particular, I will focus on Davidson's path to his first and career-making philosophical paper, which took up a number of issues in the theory of action. I show how Davidson combined an appreciation of formal methods arising from the tradition of scientific philosophy with an evolving expertise in theories of decision, behavior, and value. Such a perspective can enable us better to grasp the dynamic, interdisciplinary, and strikingly open-ended context in which the formal methods of European scientific philosophy were taken up by philosophers in the United States. My account of Davidson's intellectual formation will, I hope, provide the outlines of a productive new framework for investigating the constitution of American philosophy and related disciplines in the second half of the 20th century. Since its publication in 1963, Donald Davidson's essay, Actions, Reasons, and Causes, has become a classic of post-war analytic philosophy. Davidson considered his paper a reaction against a widely accepted doctrine that the explanation of an intentional action in terms of its motives or reasons could not relate reasons and actions as cause and effect. When Davidson composed his intervention, it was widely agreed that a reason explained an action by redescribing it in such a way as to give the agent reason for performing the action. According to a number of prominent philosophers, however, this redescription had nothing to do with the explanatory scheme of cause and effect, because, as Davidson glossed this position, causal relations are essentially nomological and based on induction, while our knowledge that an agent has acted on reasons is not usually dependent on induction or knowledge of serious laws. The repudiation of causal schemes in the explanation of social action was shared by two overlapping groups of philosophers, thinkers who Davidson labelled neo-Wittgensteinians, Elizabeth Anscombe, Abraham Meldon, Anthony Kenny, and Peter Winch, among others, and Oxonian ordinary language philosophers, notably Gilbert Ryle, Stuart Hampshire, and H.L.A. Hart. Davidson's principal criticism of these causal skeptics was that the case against causation in explanations that invoked reasons had not been made. There were two parts to this argument of Davidson's. The first sketched an account of what was involved in explaining an action by citing an agent's reason for performing it, while the second defended the thesis that, when properly understood, the construction of an agent's reason for performing an action necessarily involved treating the reason as the cause of that action. Although Davidson insisted that the second claim followed directly from his account of the proper form of a reason explanation or rationalization, his remarks in support of the treatment of reasons as causes rested on a survey of the limits of contemporary action theory. This theory, according to Davidson, went opaque at the point where it departed from the explanatory scheme of cause and effect. In response to the supposedly telling anti-causal observation that reasons alone justify actions in the course of explaining them, Davidson pointed out that the appeal to justification did not tie reasons to actions in a way that would be explanatory. Specifically, it did not take account of the possibility that a person, and I'm quoting Davidson here, a person can have a reason for an action and perform the action, and yet this reason not be the reason why he did it. Central to the relation between a reason and an action it explains is the idea that the agent performed the action because he had the reason. What this meant, Davidson said, was that neo-Wittgensteinian remarks about redescribing actions so that they were situated within broader explanation-yielding patterns of rules, norms, conventions, forms of life, and so on. These remarks amounted to so much hand-waving until such patterns could bridge the gap between showing that an agent had a reason to act and did act, and that this was the reason, in fact, the action was performed. But then what else could one say other than that the agent performed the action because they had the reason cited as its explanation? Davidson devoted much of the second half of his essay to explicating and defending the concept of causation contained within that because. The significance of these claims becomes clearer when we consider the first programmatic part of Davidson's argument. For Davidson, giving a reason for an agent's action involved the construction of what he called a primary reason. A primary reason attributed to an agent two dispositions or states. First, a pro-attitude, paradigmatically a desire, but more generally any evaluative attitude in reference to which an action would appeal to the agent. And second, a belief or some form of recognition that the action in question possessed the appealing property. An action, like other events or objects, was usually given alternative descriptions. Davidson acknowledged that the desires and beliefs identified in the citation of a primary reason could explain an action only under the description in terms of which an agent would have regarded the appealing action when they formed the relevant desires and beliefs. In Actions, Reasons, and Causes, this reflection served to underscore the importance of explaining actions in the terms that the agent saw it. By flipping a switch, I may inadvertently alert a prowler to the fact that I am home, but I performed the action because I wanted to turn on the light and believed that flipping the switch would satisfy that desire. Davidson's essay was quickly recognised as a tour de force, ostensibly a defence of the ancient and common sense position that rationalisation is a species of causal explanation. Davidson's paper displayed an extensive roster of analytical philosophical topics: scientific explanation, logical form, causation, the theory of decision, and so on. But who was Donald Davidson? Of course, he's recognised today as one of the major philosophers of the last third of the 20th century. But in 1963, the question would not have been rhetorical. When Actions appeared in the flagship journal of philosophy, Davidson was in his mid-40s and a largely unpublished associate professor at Stanford University. He described his presentation of the paper at a meeting of the American Philosophical Association in 1963 as, in many ways, my first real public performance. I now turn to survey the sources of his seminal reorientation of discussions of agency and the explanation of social action. And in doing so, I aim to reveal a rather different context in which an analytic mainstream was forged in American philosophy. In Actions, Reasons and Causes, Davidson self-consciously engaged issues first raised in Aristotle's discussions of the nature of practical reasoning and the sources of voluntary action. These classical sources became especially important to Davidson when he turned in later essays to consider the problems posed for his causal theory of action by the phenomenon of akrasia, when agents acted intentionally against their own best judgments. It was in Aristotle that Davidson found the ancient view of the causal relation between reasons and actions that he sought to defend. Especially appealing to Davidson was the assessment provided in De Anima of the sources of voluntary actions in the conjunction of appetite and thought. In Davidson's Aristotle, it was always an appetite or aversion that initiated the causal chain, with the faculty of reason cast in the role of calculating the means to the desired end. Aristotle's description of the nature of practical reasoning rendered the causal connections between desire, belief, and action particularly strong. It proposed that the conclusion of a piece of practical reasoning, modelled in part on the syllogism, was not a decision or a belief, but an action, given an appetite or evaluative attitude toward a certain end, and the rational discovery of an available means to that end, an agent concluding a practical syllogism would straight away act. These classical ideas were an essential part of the background against which Davidson developed his theory of action. Nevertheless, in Actions, Reasons and Causes, Davidson was firm about the need to redeploy, as he put it, Aristotle's claims. In subsequent essays, he made clear his sense of the limitations of Aristotle's theory of voluntary action when it came to handling conflicting values, decisions among alternatives, and the weakness of the will. In the 1963 paper, these difficulties arose most starkly in connection with the question of how useful Aristotelian accounts of action could be in predicting future actions. A significant shortcoming of the Aristotelian practical syllogism, Davidson observed, was that it exhausted its role in displaying an action as falling under one reason. Yet, to Davidson, it seemed obvious that what emerged in the ex post facto atmosphere of explanation and justification as the reason frequently was, to the agent at the time of action, one consideration among many, a reason. Consequently, any serious theory for predicting action on the basis of reasons must find a way of evaluating the relative force of various desires and beliefs in the matrix of decision. This was why the practical syllogism could not be subtilized into a reconstruction of practical reasoning, which involves the weighing of competing reasons. It offered, concluded Davidson, a model neither for a predictive science of action nor for a normative account of evaluative reasoning. Here, Davidson indicated the kind of redeployment of Aristotle he had in mind. Although the commitment goes largely unstated in Actions, Reasons, and Causes, Davidson's criteria for a powerful predictive science of action and a normative account of rationality were drawn from his work in the field of decision theory. His discussion of primary reasons also mapped onto his research in this area. In order fully to understand the kind of intervention Davidson was making in his famous 1963 essay then, it is necessary to uncover the sources of these commitments. Davidson was a second-year graduate student at Harvard when Bertrand Russell gave his James Lectures in 1940. Between 1939 and 1941, and then again for a brief spell in 1945, Davidson studied in the combined field of classics and philosophy, albeit with growing ambivalence. Upon graduation from Harvard College in 1939, Davidson had been offered a studentship in classical philosophy on the strength of his senior honors thesis, which explored Plato's concept of human excellence as described in the Philebus. Soon after he began graduate studies, however, Davidson found himself turned around, as he put it, by W.V. Quine's course on logical positivism. Billed as a critical survey of the views of the Vienna Circle and related authors, Quine's course taught Davidson, and I'm quoting Davidson here, that it was possible to be serious about getting things right in philosophy, or at least not getting things wrong. By the time Russell, Carnap, Tarski and the others gathered in Cambridge in 1940, Davidson was moving in their direction philosophically, but obliged to write a dissertation on Plato. The war intervened to make Davidson's uneasy transition from classicist to analytic philosopher yet more protracted. From 1942 until the end of the war, Davidson served in the US Navy. After a brief return to Harvard upon demobilization, he took up a teaching post at Queens College in New York. Although Davidson eventually completed a dissertation on the Philebus in 1947, he admitted his aim by that point was to write about Plato in as analytic and contemporary mode as I could. When, in December 1950, Davidson accepted an invitation from his old department chair at Queens to join the faculty at Stanford University, he retained only a teaching interest in classical philosophy and had as yet no special field or project to call his own. Because of a remarkable transformation in the political economy of California and its universities, Stanford would play a very active role in shaping Davidson's philosophical ideas. To understand why, we need some regional history. During the Second World War, California had benefited from a bonanza of federal spending, which targeted aeronautics, shipbuilding, basic metals, and oil, but also encompassed the construction and maintenance of large military facilities across the state. California had been the marshalling ground for America's war in the Pacific. The de facto nationalization of the Golden State's hitherto underdeveloped economy entailed not just the short-term expansion of employment opportunities in the military sector, but also the government-subsidized expansion of industries like petroleum, metals, and aviation, and the emerging high-tech field of electronics. After a brief economic slump immediately following the end of the war, the California population exploded. Manufacturing employment boomed as the military, the federal government, and the state's captains of industry worked out a modus vivendi centered on sustained federal patronage and public sector markets for aviation, shipbuilding, construction, and high-tech R&D. Universities and the scientists and scholars who staffed them were compelled rapidly to adapt to the transformed political economy of the American West. A select band of institutions were primed to thrive in the new climate. During the war, the Office of Scientific Research and Development, which oversaw all government-sponsored research, had contracted out vital work to a small subset of universities under extraordinarily favorable terms. The contracting institution received, in addition to direct costs incurred, an overhead payment at a flat rate of 50%. These payments for indirect costs were used in most cases as unrestricted funds by grateful university administrators. A small number of institutions received the lion's share of federal largesse, which was doled out by OSRD Director Vannevar Bush and his colleagues with little congressional oversight. In the East, Harvard and MIT dramatically expanded their research operations on the back of government contracts. In the West, meanwhile, the University of California and Caltech were given crucial contracts relating to the Manhattan Project and jet propulsion technology, respectively. Thanks to the post-war settlement, both UC and Caltech were asked to handle large research facilities run during the war by the armed services. As the Second World War drew to a close, Stanford was in a more precarious situation than its California neighbors. It had missed out on the big wartime contracts, in part because the leaders of the scientific establishment were interested in hot-housing a small number of favored institutions, and in part because of the Stanford trustees' deep hostility to the idea of public funding for what was a private university. Some of this attitude persisted into the post-war years, when Stanford president Donald Tressider had attempted to stay true to trustee Herbert Hoover's anti-statist principles and attract money for the university from the private sector. This was an epic failure. However, another important Stanford figure was prescient enough to see that a much larger game was afoot, and that if Stanford was to adapt to the new regime, it would have to revise its principles. Frederick Terman was chair of the Department of Electrical Engineering when, in 1942, he was called by his dissertation advisor, Vannevar Bush, to direct the radio research laboratory at Harvard. Although he shared Tressider's and Hoover's view of the natural relationship between private universities and the public sector, Terman's stewardship of the RRL, which was Harvard's largest state-sponsored lab, showed him which way the wind was blowing. Terman realized two things: that electronics, along with other technologies developed in military labs during the war, would have potentially lucrative commercial applications, and second of all, that the state, and especially military patrons, would fuel the R&D economy after the war. Those universities with closest relations to government patrons would grow in wealth and reputation. Any private sector alliances would flourish only once that patronage relationship between universities and the state was secure. Upon his return to Stanford in 1945, Terman was determined to ensure that the university would follow the path of Harvard, MIT, and Caltech. Stanford would become either the Harvard of the West, he wrote, or it faced the ignominy of being its Dartmouth. First as Dean of the School of Engineering, and then as Provost, Terman restructured Stanford's faculty and research infrastructure in ways that would allow it to attract funding from military and other federal government patrons. In the late 1940s, the most important source of funding came from the military, and especially from the Office of Naval Research, which paid contract overhead in the same generous fashion as had Bush's OSRD during the war. Terman knew that most of this funding was going to defense-related research in physics, electronics, and applied mathematics, and so he made it his objective to appoint men in these areas who were reliably able to secure contracts. Many, like Terman himself, had held contracts during the war in such areas as radar countermeasures, operations research, computing, and nuclear physics. Because he often appointed researchers who were already sponsored by agencies like the ONR, he could split their salaries between Stanford's operating budget and the funds gathered from contract overhead. These savings meant he could make further appointments and once again salary split by appointing scientists capable of gathering contracts. Through the 1950s, Terman built nationally recognized steeples of excellence at Stanford in physics, engineering, and statistics in just this manner. Moreover, the contract research these burgeoning departments did for the military was soon fed to the commercial sector, as new businesses in electronics, aeronautics, and related industries began to gather in Palo Alto and to hire Stanford faculty as consultants. Terman encouraged these links by establishing in 1951 the Stanford Industrial Park, now the heartland of Silicon Valley. Corporations like Varian Associates and Packard Bell benefited from expertise developed under government contracts at Stanford, and then sold the resulting commercial technologies to the US military, among other customers. A growth strategy of this scale and complexity required an especially flexible not to say dictatorial administrative structure, and Terman did not hesitate to downgrade the priorities of disciplines and department chairs and make appointments and accept contracts that fit with his general growth plan. Working in the fluid but increasingly patronage-focused environment of Cold War Stanford had two significant consequences for Donald Davidson's nascent project in philosophy. First, Davidson enjoyed the blessing and the burden of working in an understaffed but increasingly well-resourced department. He was obliged to teach across and thereby train himself in a broad range of subjects. He taught Plato and Aristotle, an ethics survey course, epistemology, mathematical logic at introductory and advanced levels, philosophy of language, the aesthetics of music, and value theory. At the same time, Davidson had a free hand to bring in visiting professors and guest speakers from the East Coast in Britain. Davidson's guests at Stanford during the 1950s included Gilbert Ryle, W.V. Quine, Peter Strawson, J.L. Austin, Elizabeth Anscombe, Michael Dummett, David Pears, Peter Geach, Paul Grice, and David Wiggins. This provided a stimulus for Davidson to think about Neo-Wittgensteinian and ordinary language doctrines in the theory of action and also in the philosophy of language. Davidson was thus able to give himself an extensive education in the main currents of post-war philosophy. But the influence of Stanford on his philosophical development did not end there. Fred Terman followed Harvard President James Bryant Conant's demand for the self-sustaining financing of the departments of a university. Every tub on its own bottom was Conant's maxim, and at Stanford, this required the collection of soft money and the practice of salary splitting. Terman insisted, moreover, that humanities departments stand on their own two feet. Philosophy department chair John Goheen did his bit by negotiating contracts with the group psychology branch of the Office of Naval Research and the Office of Ordnance Research of the United States Army for work on the theory of decisions involving risk. In 1953, he also won a grant from the Ford Foundation's Behavioral Sciences Division to conduct a group study on values, decisions, and rationality, an enterprise that eventually became the Stanford Value Theory Project. Each of these grants and contracts involved interdisciplinary research and cross-faculty collaboration, and they changed inexorably the profile of the philosophy department. One faculty member in particular did more than Goheen to attract and sustain external funding streams. Patrick Supes was a philosopher of science and methodologist who had been hired fresh from Columbia's graduate program in 1950. Under Supes' influence, and with the ONR and Army Ordnance contracts increasingly crucial to the department's viability, the intellectual orientation of the philosophy program was drawn more toward logic, applied mathematics, and problems in econometrics and psychological scaling. Davidson was drawn into Supes' orbit, and in the process encountered formal methods in philosophy in the context of applied interdisciplinary research. To see how this conditioned Davidson's reception of the tools and techniques of scientific philosophy, we need to look a little more closely at his work during the 1950s. In 1952, the department hired J.C.C. McKinsey, a pioneering game theorist and logician who had been working at the Rand Corporation in Santa Monica. Soon, McKinsey, Supes, and Davidson were collaborating on a set of experimental and theoretical studies in decision theory. As Davidson put the matter, Supes and McKinsey took him under their wing. Their initial plan was to write a paper on the implications for ethical theory of decision theory. This duly appeared in the journal Philosophy of Science in 1953 as Outlines of a Formal Theory of Value, Part 1. Parts 2 and 3, for various reasons, never appeared. Meanwhile, Supes and McKinsey set out to improve Davidson's education, specifically, as Davidson later recalled, by giving him, as an exercise, and I'm quoting Davidson here, the simple task of axiomatizing decision theory on the basis of a new primitive concept. For Davidson, the exercise was totally unlike anything I was prepared for, but very much in line with what Alfred Tarski was training his students to do. Both Supes and McKinsey were close to Tarski, who is by now a professor across the bay at Berkeley. Although Mackenzie died unexpectedly in 1953, Soupice had set a course for the philosophy department at Stanford that centred on a programme of axiomatization in the mathematical sciences and related work in psychological metrics and value theory. Ever the entrepreneur, Soupice began in the early 1950s to split his time and salary between philosophy and Stanford's Laboratory of Applied Mathematics and Statistics, a magnet for soft money. Soupice picked up the first of many ONR contracts in the stats lab and was rapidly promoted up the ranks, becoming a close confidant of Terman's in the process. In the late 1950s, Soupice had become, in his own words, a conduit for Terman to make good appointments in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. Soupice's vision for philosophy, according to Davidson, was clear: to hire logicians who knew something about other subjects. Around the time that Actions, Reasons, and Causes was published, Davidson was chair of a department that included its own logic division, staffed by Tarski students or peers George Kreisel, Dana Scott, Solomon Pfefferman, and William Tate. The general staff of the department had many of its own experts in logic and axiomatic methods, including Jaco Hintikker, Richard Jeffrey, David Niverson, and Soupice and Davidson. Here was a department reconstructed in line with Terman's principles. A neophyte in the formal program being put together by Soupice, Davidson completed his homework assignments and around 1953 hit upon an empirical solution for a central conceptual problem in decision theory. Decision theorists were interested in the calculations an agent carried out in deciding between alternatives, one or more of which were gambles, that is, choices whose outcomes depended on a chance event or an unknown state of nature. It was evident that an agent's decision between alternatives whose outcome was uncertain would be governed by two factors: their calculation of the probable outcome of the gambles between which they were choosing, their so-called subjective probability, and the value they attached to the possible outcomes of their choice, their subjective utility. The difficulty faced by those in the early 1950s who wanted to make decision theory a powerful empirical theory of risky decisions was that subjective probabilities and subjective utilities were hard to disentangle. When Davidson began working on the topic, a number of economists, psychologists, and statisticians had suggested empirically testable models for measuring expected utilities given certain patterns of preference revealed in choice behavior. The problem was that the results of experiments carried out with these models were chronically ambiguous, insofar as the scaling of probabilities usually relied on making assumptions about the agent's utilities, or vice versa. As a result, empirical choice behavior could usually be explained in two incompatible ways. The key was to find a way of gauging one element without making assumptions about the other. Davidson was delighted to find a way of structuring a choice between gambles such that an agent's indifference between them would show two things. First, that they thought the events on which the outcome of the gambles depended, say a fair coin's chances of coming up heads or tails, were equally likely. And second, that the combined outcomes of each gamble were of equal value to the agent. Given this information about the setup of the gambles and about the agent's choices, one could measure their utilities and probabilities without making strong assumptions about one to determine the other. Davidson's discovery was not, in the event, epoch-making. Frank Ramsey had outlined a similar method for assigning subjective probabilities and utilities on the basis of choice behavior in his remarkable but, in the early 1950s, little-known paper, Truth and Probability, written in 1926. Nevertheless, Davidson and Soupice were able to outline a new set of axioms for choice involving risk that could be tested in controlled conditions. Davidson's experiments, conducted with Soupice and others, produced a stream of articles and technical reports in a field of study, that united statisticians, psychologists, economists, and philosophers. Davidson co-authored a paper in Econometrica and reported with the economist Jacob Marshak on a method for measuring utilities in experimental settings, somewhat different from that described by Ramsey. In 1957, Davidson published with Supes the book Decision Making, an Experimental Approach, which was a founding text in the field of experimental economics. Although these studies were not explicitly philosophical, Davidson certainly felt that the techniques he had picked up in the broad field of decision theory and axiomatic methodology helped to make clearer more general issues in the philosophy of action, the theory of scientific explanation, and related fields in analytic philosophy. By 1960, while still addressing formal problems in decision theory, Davidson was already speaking in terms that would resonate in actions, reasons, and causes. In a paper for the International Congress for Logic, Methodology, and Philosophy of Science, an enterprise of Supes and Tarski, Davidson argued that formal theories of decision dealing with voluntary actions had to interpret the set of alternatives or actions between which choices or decisions are made in the same way it is interpreted by the subject. This was the language of subjective probabilities and subjective utilities, but also a methodological stricture he would invoke in his discussion of primary reasons. Modern theories of decision, Davidson also claimed in this paper, explain and predict decisions in the same way theories in other branches of science explain and predict the phenomena with which they deal. Actions or decisions for Davidson at this point were not to be explained outside of the conceptual resources of the sciences generally. And again, this was a conviction that found voice in Davidson's 1963 paper. Davidson's work on actions, reasons, and causes began in earnest in the spring of 1963, when Sidney Morgan-Besser, the editor of the Journal of Philosophy, solicited from Davidson a review of one of the Wittgensteinian red books then appearing from the presses, Anthony Kenny's Action, Emotion, and Will. Morgan-Besser encouraged Davidson to, and I'm quoting Morgan-Besser here, take the opportunity to discuss your own ideas on utility, game theory, etc., using the Kenny book as a springboard. And Davidson, naturally enough, did draw on some of the concepts and theoretical commitments he found in decision theory and related areas of the mathematical and behavioral sciences. I do not, however, want to describe Davidson's seminal paper as some kind of Cold War-inspired marriage of Aristotle and game theory. Readers of Actions, Reasons, and Causes and related essays of Davidson's on the nature of agency, the interpretation of behavior, and the philosophy of mind will know that despite their author's frequent gestures toward his experimental work in the 1950s, much of the art of Davidson's inquiries lies in his exploration of the limits of strict formal theories. The conclusion I wish to draw points us back toward the transformation of American philosophy by formal methods and concepts originating, at least in part, from the migration of scientific philosophy in mid-century. What I want to insist upon is that Davidson's early career shows us that the patrimony of European scientific philosophy was received in an extraordinarily dynamic context. At Stanford, Davidson did not face an inert body of doctrine or methodology, but instead moved across a landscape of methods and problems drawn from across the mathematical and behavioral sciences. Tarski's methodology of science, expected utility theory, statistical theories of probability, Wittgenstein's later philosophy, all of these and more encountered in the stream of a rapidly moving research culture. It was in this open field that post-war philosophers, soon to be associated with analytic and even post-analytic approaches, pieced together projects in action theory, the philosophy of language, epistemology, ethics, and the general theory of value. Certainly, not all philosophers were as content as Davidson to play the sleepy spider for the better part of two decades before publishing in philosophy. But the general picture of an analytic tradition forged in a deeply interdisciplinary research culture premised on a well-funded program in the mathematical and behavioral sciences seems fitting. Lest this sound too laissez-faire, let me point out in conclusion two important characteristics of this broad spectrum of formal methods in philosophy, as Davidson and others encountered them. The first concerns the changes wrought in scientific philosophy by the Second World War. During the decade leading up to the American intervention in the war, a number of former members of the Vienna Circle had recanted their commitment to the doctrine of verificationism, and instead began both to address the logic of inductive reasoning and to speak of degrees of confirmation in the theory of knowledge. These debates about probability and induction were part of the heritage of logical empiricism in the United States. But the war transformed formal concerns with the structure of scientific languages and the epistemological problem of confirmation into eminently practical challenges. These formal methods were encountered as tools used in the assessment of decision-making and complex operations. Such an emphasis marked the later work of Davidson, Supes, and others in the field of decision theory and measurement. Some historical background will help to fill out this claim. Following the lead of the British, who employed civilian scientists like PMS Blackett to plan and assess military operations during the war, Vannevar Bush created the Applied Mathematics Panel as a division of the Wartime Office of Scientific Research and Development under the leadership of Warren Weaver. This was an American counterpart to the British OR units. Weaver, in turn, contracted out to Columbia, Princeton, and a handful of other universities for applied work on the effectiveness of bombing strategies, anti-aircraft fire patterns, and general calculations for the improvement or best use of weapons technologies. These groups of civilian scientists were typically directed and staffed by statisticians, but they often included experts in mathematical logic. Columbia's Statistical Research Group, for example, which was the largest of the groups under contract with Weaver's panel, employed as researchers or associates Leonard Savage, George Stigler, Frederick Mosteller, and Milton Friedman. It is often correctly noted that the Second World War, for all of its expansion of the field of statistics and probability theory, did not produce a revolution in this area as it had in computing or electronics. But it had two other notable effects. First, it confirmed among US-based statisticians and theorists of probability a concern for the subjective interpretation of probability. Probability conceived as a measure of subjective belief rather than as a measure of frequency. These different interpretations of the theory of probability had been a source of fierce debate before the war and would become so again, but for a time, the war stacked the deck in favor of the subjectivists. Second, operations research offered some philosophers of science a model of their own of their discipline. During the war, OR teams in the US military were not limited to studies of ordnance and were asked to examine battlefield operations, the organization of supply chains for the armed services, and R&D in the wartime's weapons labs. After the war, this kind of expertise among logicians and statisticians was parlayed into consultancy work for the armed services. The RAND Corporation, which began life as an Air Force-funded research and development division of the Douglas Aircraft Company, employed several philosophers and logicians. These included two philosophers whom Bertrand Russell had taught at the University of Chicago, Abraham Kaplan and Norman Dalkey, along with Olaf Helmer, J.C.C. McKinsey, and indeed an emigre logical empiricist, Hans Reichenbach. Even W.V. Quine landed a summer gig at RAND, where he tinkered with Kenneth Arrow's impossibility theory, which was another RAND product. For some, philosophy of science was no longer a metamathematical or linguistic exercise in the logic of science, as Carnap imagined it to be. It was an applied discipline that dealt with methodological issues from across the sciences, from problems in measurement to questions of decision, strategy, and general value. In the decade after 1945, C. West Churchman, Patrick Supes, and Russell Acuff devoted articles in the journal Philosophy of Science to sketches for a new applied approach in the discipline, one closely modelled on the operations research tradition. All of which is to say that Davidson and his peers were not simply picking and choosing freely among formal methods when they hit upon significant seeming problems in theories of decision or probability theory. These interests had been prepared by the exigencies of applied research in the war, and this influence, and the influence this had on philosophical methods in the Cold War system of research patronage. The second closely related characteristic in the open field of formal methods I am describing involves the concept of value, and I shall close with some observations on this crucial topic. As we have seen, The central feature of decision theory was its combination of assessments of subjective probability with measures of subjective utility, a twin concern that led Savage, Friedman, and Mosteller from their work for the Applied Mathematics Panel during the war to applied work in expected utility theory. It is important here not to be misled by the economic terminology and to recognize that so-called utility theory in the immediate post-war period was not the sole provenance of economics professors. It was connected to an interdisciplinary sector of the behavioral sciences that focused on evaluative reasoning. Statisticians, psychologists, philosophers, and economists were interested in connecting probability theory, inductive logic, and decision-making to the theory of value. Although this was in many respects a heady conjunction of ideas forged by applied research during the war, it also belonged to a venerable strand of American philosophy. Through the 1940s and early 1950s, philosophers like John Dewey, Clarence Irving Lewis, and Ralph Barton Perry sought to make a case for what they called an empirical ethics, a theory of value judgments consonant with the predictive empirical judgments perfected, so people like Lewis believed, in the experimental sciences. Economic and psychological discussions of utility were not foreign to these thinkers. Although normative political theory may have fared poorly in the new regime of behavioral and mathematical sciences, concepts of value and ethics did not disappear from the scene as the analytic tradition in America took shape. Davidson's work on decision theory was especially ecumenical in its treatment of the problem of value. His 1953 paper with Supes and McKinsey, Outlines of a Formal Theory of Value, took care to address, if in a critical fashion, the accounts of evaluative reasoning presented by Dewey, Lewis, and Ralph Barton Perry. Davidson's notes for the paper indicate that he was the author pushing for this wider philosophical orientation. In addition, the formal limits placed on rational patterns of preferences in the essay were deliberately designed to be weak. The intent of Davidson and his co-authors was simply to present a definition of a rational ordering among a set of options and to establish the possibility of measuring utilities. In the years after he published Outlines, Davidson offered a seminar in formal value theory in which he addressed a remarkable array of texts from across the disciplines. His work for this seminar encompassed studies in game theory by Anatole Rapoport, R.M. Hare's The Language of Morals, Kenneth Arrow's Social Choice and Individual Values, Stephen Tallman's early treatise on ethics, John Rawls's Two Concepts of Rules, an article from 1955, Felix Kaufmann's Methodology of the Social Sciences. The list goes on. As he was beginning this research, Davidson described his general research program as the study of the character of inference, evidence, postulation, and concept formation in ethics and other modes of value. A few years later, he was promising the American Council of Learned Societies that he would write a book, which never appeared, on the logic and psychology of moral reasoning, with an emphasis on the relations between philosophical problems and decision-making as studied by economists, psychologists, and other social scientists. In the 1950s, Davidson saw his project as relevant to moral philosophy, ethics, and decision theory, among other fields. Both the war and the philosophical culture of Stanford itself meant that he did not expressly need to choose between these options. So Davidson, like many post-war philosophers, was operating in a remarkably open field in which the methods and programs of logicians, philosophers of science, economists, statisticians, and psychologists were inextricably entangled. In Actions, Reasons, and Causes, Davidson managed to put that heritage to work in a revisionist account of the explanation of action. This account called upon, but to be sure in important ways, went beyond his training in the mathematical and behavioral sciences. With further specification of the interactions between decision theory, utility theory, statistics, and scientific philosophy, we could, I think, shed more light on cognate projects in American analytic philosophy of the 1950s and 1960s. What we need in the study of the analytic tradition in the United States is not a story of declension or triumph revolving around the émigré logical positivists and their interlocutors. We need to know about the array of formalisms emerging from upheavals across the disciplines in the middle decades of the 20th century, and their integration into the projects that defined post-war American philosophy. That will take both institutional studies and detailed textual exegesis. I hope to have made a small contribution to those tasks in this lecture. Thank you.